From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and a big sigh of relief for some investors today as stocks rebounded in the U.S. but plummeted again in China today, closing 7% lower.
That crash wiped out more than $1 trillion from Shanghai stocks in the last 4 days. And watching closely, the startups and tech giants in Silicon Valley that make up one of the fastest growing industries in the U.S. Let's start there with Carmel Diamichis, associate editor with the tech news site Recode, our partner in tech coverage. She's in San Francisco. So, Carmel, we've asked about Wall Street. What's the mood there?
I would say the mood in San Francisco is wary right now. Even though there's been some correction in the U.S. stock market, I don't think that startups feel like they're completely out of the woods.
Yeah. Well,
at
why?
This point.
Is it about selling things to China's huge market, or is it about getting money from investors who might not have as much now? What's the concern?
I think it's a mix of factors. It depends on the company and the person, of course. So there are obviously several big tech giants that have stakes in China. I personally cover Uber and Airbnb, who have both made big commitments to the China market. Mm. So they're concerned about consumer spending habits in China. They're a little worried about investor sentiment over there. Uber in particular has been raising money for the China market, and this isn't going to help its efforts at all. For the rest of the companies who might not have a stake in the China market, there's a shift in sentiment. I don't think even if the stocks continue to perform well in the U.S., that people are going to feel entirely at ease for a while. This felt a little bit like the rug getting pulled out from under them.
Well, and some think that maybe there is a lesson here for Silicon Valley. You write about investors sending warning tweets to startup founders saying, you know, hey, profits might have to matter, you know, more than growth. Explain that.
Yeah, so I would say for years now, money has come easy and cheap. They say money has come cheap. That's mm-hmm. the term. And so people have been told to place far more emphasis on growth than profits, to the point where people are buying users for their companies, whether through marketing or through major subsidies like you see with Uber, free rides, paying drivers $500 to sign up. And so I don't think just with the recent events that started to shift, I think for the last few months, there's been conversations in back rooms during fundraising rounds, I've been told, where investors are starting to ask, you know, what are your plans for a rainy day? What are your unit economics look like when we're not backing you? When you take the venture money out of it, how much does it cost you to provide this service?
Do I smell sock puppet? What was it? The pet company that had the sock puppet and then just about that's about all it had.
Pets.com.
Right.
It kind of Webvan. I mean, there's a huge list of former horror stories that people know very well.
Well, so maybe there's a bit of a correction here for Silicon Valley, and yet there was a big hit on some companies yesterday. Talk about Apple CEO weighing in to do a little bit of damage control. Very unusual.
Yes. So that was entertaining. For those of you who don't know, Apple CEO Tim Cook actually sent an email to CNBC's Jim Cramer, essentially defending what's happening in China and saying, you know, this isn't going to hurt us as much as you think it is, because Apple had lost so much in its stock in a short period of time. And that's very rare. Apple is usually pretty mum in between quarters about their financial performance. And so he's aware, and I think everyone's aware, that people are nervous, and sometimes nerves can spiral out of control. Like, fundamentally, people's psychology does play a big role in what happens in a stock market correction. It's not all numbers. So it makes sense that he would do that, although some of us were entertained that Jim Cramer has Tim Cook on speed dial.
Jim Cramer, people remember, he's the guy who just really is kind of outside in his CNBC broadcasting. But who else got hurt yesterday?
I mean, so I personally cover the unicorns. That's my main focus.
Oh, let's remind people. The unicorns used to be such an unusual thing. They were called a unicorn because it was startups that have $1 billion. And now there's a lot of them. But those are the unicorns,
yes.
Right? Yep.
Not even have $1 billion. They're believed to be worth $1 billion, right, which is sort of a made up number in investors' heads. It's not necessarily based on any real metrics. So that's been my main focus. In terms of the public tech companies, obviously Alibaba and Twitter have been suffering for some time now. We're seeing them return to pre-IPO stock prices, and you know, that's partially the result of what's happening in the market. I think it's also partially a result of people wondering whether they're not worth as much as was believed when they first went public.
So an interesting day in the Silicon Valley world. Carmel Diamichis, associate editor with Recode, on how this big dip in the stock market affected people in the startups. Carmel, thank you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, there was an emergency government meeting today in Lebanon, but still no solution to the garbage crisis there. Trash is piled up in heaps on the streets of Beirut, sparking angry protests by thousands of people in recent days. The protests are being organized by activists under the banner, "You Stink." Joining us now from Beirut is Rami Khoury, a syndicated columnist for The Daily Star and a senior public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut. And Rami, why isn't the garbage being picked up?
Well, the garbage is just one element of many different issues that cause real pain and frustration and anger to millions of citizens. You have electricity cuts. You have increasing salination of the home water supply because of the dropping water tables. Terrible public transport. The education system is in bad shape. So there's many, many problems. The trash problem was the one that broke the camel's back, I guess we'd say, because the accumulation of huge piles of garbage, you're talking of, you know, piles of garbage that were 30 or 40 yards long and 10, 15 yards high, you know, little mountains of garbage right in the middle of every block in the city. And it created, it was annoying at first, and then it's a health hazard. But what it mostly showed was that the government was both incompetent and uncaring. It didn't care what happened to ordinary citizens, and it was incompetent in addressing this issue. And most people felt that there was huge corruption in the government because of the way these contracts were given. So the garbage was just one element that pushed people over the edge to finally go out and protest as they did.
And you say that this larger movement is sort of like a delayed coming of the Arab Spring to Lebanon, which it did not touch in the first round.
That's true. The Arab uprisings that started in early 2011 were basically popular uprisings against corrupt, brutal, and oppressive governments like Tunisia, like Syria, like Egypt. And people were feeling the pain of being physically oppressed by their government, thousands of people thrown into jail, beaten up by police, et cetera, et cetera. That never happened in Lebanon because we don't have a strong central government. Power is very decentralized, and there's actually a weak central government. Historically, it's been weak, but it's never been incompetent and uncaring the way it has been in the last few years. So what the people are rising up against in Lebanon is the combination of the lack of any sense of feeling among government officials that they really care about what's happening in the lives of ordinary citizens, the corruption that permeates a lot of the government in the eyes of many of the protesters, and the incompetence in addressing issues that are pretty mechanical issues like delivering water and picking up the garbage. So it's that combination of things. So in the totality of the demonstrations and in the government response, we're seeing a very clear mirror reflection of what happened in the uprisings in other Arab countries. The only difference is the numbers are smaller here. We had about 20,000 people out the other night on Sunday night. We'll see what happens this weekend. But there's no doubt that there is a huge support for these demonstrations by the silent majority. I would say clearly over half the Lebanese people support these demonstrations.
And Lebanon, of course, in a very important spot on the globe, right there with the Mediterranean Sea off to the west, Syria surrounding it on a couple of sides, and then Israel also bordering Lebanon. Is the U.S. likely to get involved here and make it known what Washington supports in this fight?
Well, Washington, throughout the last couple of decades in the Middle East, has been speaking about promoting democracy and supporting citizen rights and freedom of expression and all of these things. And it said that the ambassador said that again yesterday here, that, you know, the demonstrators should have the right to demonstrate peacefully. The problem is that the overall American policy has been for decades to make sure that Lebanon is weak and cannot ever be a threat to Israel. And this is the real problem. So when the Lebanese army tries to buy some fancy equipment from somebody, the U.S. starts threatening it and says, you can't buy, we won't give you money, or we'll block the export of military hardware, because the U.S. just doesn't want Lebanon to have any kind of military power that could possibly threaten Israel. Of course, that policy backfired, because what happened was Hezbollah came into being, and Hezbollah is much more powerful militarily than the Lebanese government. So the consequences of American policies over the years have been really quite ineffective in most cases. So people just don't pay much attention to what the U.S. says anymore, unfortunately.
That's Rami Khoury, a syndicated columnist for the Daily Star and a senior public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut, joining us from Beirut, Lebanon, where there have been these protests going on. Rami, thank you.
Thanks. Glad to be with you.
All this week, we're talking about immigration, and today we're going to hear from two undocumented immigrants. Our first guest is named Alejandra. She came here as an adult from Uruguay when she was 25, and she's asked that we only use her first name because she is afraid of being deported. Alejandra, welcome.
Thank you.
And tell me about how you came to this country.
I came a couple of times. First time to visit my family. My second time, I spent a year here, and my last time, by then I knew that life here, even as an undocumented, will be much easier for me than getting back to my country.
But you did get a visa when you first came.
I got a tourist visa.
A tourist visa, and you just overstayed it.
Yes.
And did you ever think twice about that? Think, maybe I shouldn't break the law in this way?
That's why I went back twice. I was trying to keep my visa. It was extremely expensive to be keep traveling. And that's why I decided that I couldn't afford to do that anymore.
And how difficult has it been to be here without documentation?
It's been very difficult. You are in constant fear, fear of driving without a license, fear that when you're working, immigration is going to make a raid, fear that they're going to knock at your door, that somebody's going to get angry with you and they're going to call immigration on you, or all sort of things.
But you do those things nonetheless. You drive without a license?
I do. I have to.
You have to. Mm-hmm. What about working? How did you manage to get a job that will pay you?
I start working for plastic factories through agencies. It was a very tough job. It was hard. The work was hard, and they don't pay you overtime. So it doesn't matter how many hours you work. There is no protections, and there is nothing that you can claim. You don't even have a check. Then, like everybody, you find the way to get yourself some numbers that you can present at your workplace.
You get some sort of a fake social security number, mm-hmm. or something like that.
Yes.
And then you're able to work wherever. Doesn't matter, because they don't know that you're undocumented.
Well, if they check, they will know. There is places when there is cheaper to have us, so they will look to the other side, right?
But in the other case, you were just being paid in cash.
Before I was paid in cash, yes.
Yeah. What's been the hardest thing about being undocumented?
Living in fear, knowing that there are certain things that it doesn't matter how capable you are, you will never get. My apartment, the lease had to be signed by my boyfriend because I don't own anything to anybody. I don't have credit. I'm nobody, technically. So I cannot even rent an apartment here.
And yet this is all a better situation than just going back to Uruguay for you.
Yes.
Why?
Because there I don't have anything. I won't be able to get a job. I came here when I was 25. And I had been working since I was 13 and was cleaning houses with no protections, with nothing. And I will never be able to make a living.
What do you think of the rhetoric that we're hearing from politicians right now about the idea, for example, of taking all of the undocumented immigrants in this country and deporting them immediately, sending them back to their countries?
Well, they are saying what a group of people that are afraid and not very well educated wanted to hear. And that's what they're selling. I think it's unfortunate that people are not being serious about solving a problem. than we have. And those 12 million people are family members of American citizens or people that have born here or have lived here for generations. So how are you going to do that?
What do you think about those who say people like you should pay a fine, go to the back of the line, but be able to remain in this country while you're doing that? Do you think that's fair? Do you think you should have to pay a fine?
I think I have paid many fines. I have paid my taxes from 15 years, and I will never be able to benefit for any of that. It may be a solution, I don't know, as a concession. It worries me more the end of the line call, because it's not a line. It's waiting for 20 years or 30 years. It's not something that is real.
There's no light at the end of the tunnel as you see it.
Yeah.
So what do you think is going to happen? Do you think that you will ever be a legal citizen of the U.S. or have some sort of legal status? Or are you just going to continue on like this forever?
It was a time a few years ago that I was very hopeful and I thought it will happen. At this point, and I know that it sounds really sad and depressing, but I don't think it will be an immigration reform.
You don't think there will be any immigration reform?
Yeah, I think that the people who benefit for having us illegal are more powerful than the fight that we're making.
Well, Alejandra, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And now let's turn to another undocumented immigrant. Graysa Martinez crossed the border from Mexico with her parents when she was a child. She's now an advocacy coordinator with an organization called United We Dream. Graysa, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about how you came to this country.
I was 7 years old, and my parents had been working the fields, and for some reason we were still starving and we're still poor. And so they decided to take the big journey to come to America. But we had to cross the Rio Grande to get home. I remember collecting seashells along the shore of the Rio Grande as we were looking for the right spot to be able to cross safely, and leaving the bag of seashells by the right spot. And so, you know, I held on to my father's hand. I was, my dad and my mom held each other, and we walked the treacherous waters of the Rio Grande.
Hmm. And you have never gotten your citizenship in all of this time?
No, I've lived in the United States for about 26 years, and there is no way, no pathway for me to be able to adjust my status.
But what does that mean for you to be undocumented? And obviously you came here when it was your parents who brought you here. It wasn't something that you decided to do on your own.
I think that many times people talk about dreamers like myself that we came here through no fault of our own. But if a person is starving and doesn't have any future in the land that they find themselves in, it's only natural and human to go and look for opportunity somewhere else. So, you know, I would have done it as well.
But what about the people who say, and I'm sure you've heard them, who say you are breaking the law? If you want to come to the United States, you should get in line and go through the legal process.
Yeah, and I definitely understand where people are coming from. My family also loves the law and being able to do the right thing. As, you know, a preacher's daughter, that's something that was embedded in my head. And what I say to them is that, you know, currently there is no legal pathway for people like myself, like my family and the 11 million undocumented families in this country to take advantage of. And so that is why I have decided to dedicate my life to figuring that out. And I know that the majority of Americans agree that the current immigration system is broken, that we need real leadership that will get us to a real solution.
What would it mean if the solution was the one that is being talked about right now by Donald Trump and others, to send everyone who's in this country illegally back to their home country?
Well, I would say I wouldn't put that as a solution. I feel that the conversation that we're having now, being led by folks like Donald Trump, is one that is irrational and not grounded on the values that this country has for centuries now evolved and developed. So that means values of family, of justice, of fairness, and of ingenuity in figuring out when there is a problem. We don't simply ignore it, but we strive together as a community to fix it.
One of the things I want to ask you about is an experience that has everything to do with your status and the status of your family, which is when your mom got sick. She needed health care, and you guys could not afford because of her illegal status in this country.
Yes. I remember being in college, coming back from a, out of all things, a spring break vacation, and we got a call from my mother telling us that she had been diagnosed with stage 2 lymphoma. And at that point, I decided to leave school and join her in Dallas, Texas, so that we can find the help that she needed to be able to survive. My sisters and I did everything we could. We took on 2 jobs and were able to navigate in and out of our own pockets pay. But there was, you know, in Dallas, Texas, we were really lucky that there was a program that that helped us pay for her medical cost, as, you know, our family was suffering through the pain and how scary it is to think that you're going to lose your mother. And, you know, as we were going through the process, it was, you know, unfathomable to think that if she were to be living in any other city, in any other state, my mother would have died only because she's undocumented. And so, you know, I think that any American, any person listening to this can sympathize on how scary that might be. But I ask you to also think about, imagine not being able to help your family member and not being able to give them the tools they needed to fight for their lives.
Gracia Martinez, who crossed the border from Mexico when she was a child with her parents, is still undocumented and is currently an advocacy coordinator with United We Dream. Gracia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And tomorrow, as we continue our series on immigration, a very different view.
Even though they remind us to some extent of our own immigrant ancestors, the question is simply, are we going to take every single person in the world who wants to come here who reminds us of our immigrant ancestors?
The Napa Valley Wine Train could soon face a lawsuit after forcing members of the Sisters on the Reading Edge Book Club, 10 black women, 1 white, to get off one of its trains over the weekend because they were loud. Here's a video the women posted just before they boarded the train.
We made it, y'all. Know, right? Look at us. We're ready to get on the wine train. Say hey.
Let me get out that
we're
picture.
Drink a little. Look like, hey, yeah, just a little bit.
See you on the train.
Well, the women say their removal from the train was racist, but train spokesman Sam Singer told the AP it wasn't, that train employees asked the women repeatedly to quiet down. He did add it was insensitive and employees will get sensitivity training. But Danielle Belton, associate editor for The Root, said it was something else. It was having fun while black. She keeps a list of the things black people can't do without getting harassed. Laugh and drink wine on a wine tour has jumped to number 1. Danielle, there's also a hashtag going around, laughing while black.
Yes.
Is this a thing? Is this something black women have felt criticized for? Exuberance?
I will say yes to that. I mean, growing up and even as an adult, when I'm out with friends, we're having a good time, I've experienced where people have gotten upset about our boisterousness.
Yeah, someone tweeted out, white is black with the joy removed. But, you know, listen, the train company says they received complaints. The staff tried 3 times to quiet the group. They were offered transportation back to Napa. Their costs were refunded. And Sam Singer, the spokesman, said that individuals, groups are asked to leave the train about once a month. So, you know, could this just be that somebody wanted a quiet train car and didn't get it?
Well, you know, I've got to say, like, I've visited wineries. You get, like, a really good mix of people, some loud, some not. You know, you're talking older couples, clubs, wine enthusiasts. And then you also get, like, groups of girlfriends who are doing their best, like, Sex in the City and the Vineyard impressions.
Yeah.
So it's like there's no promise necessarily that you're going to be able to sip in silence.
Yeah.
I mean, and we're talking wine. Even if you are quiet, it's a good chance you won't be for very long.
Well, apparently one woman said to them, you know, this is not a bar. But it sort of is. But we're laughing, and some people might. But second on your list of things that blacks can't do is be loud. That's
yes.
Funny until you read the example that you give. It's deadly serious.
Oh, extremely so. I mean, it's everything from a woman in North Dakota who was fined $150 from praying too loudly to the tragic case of Jordan Davis in 2012 where he was shot and killed in a dispute over loud music.
Yeah. Well, one of the book club members, Lisa Johnson, told CNN that, yes, they were asked to leave, but it was also sort of a perp walk. Let's listen.
We had to walk all the way through all the additional five cars to be able to get off the train. It was humiliating, degrading, and that's the part that I will never, ever, ever forget.
And just, Danielle, you know, this may be part of a national conversation. We've got about a minute left. You know, just sensitivity to how that felt. You're just your thoughts on that.
Well, it's like, you know, the train company, you know, the company that put together the wine tour called themselves trying to make this up to them, you know, by, you know, refunding their money and giving them free photographs. But who really wants photographs from the time they got thrown off the wine train by a police escort?
Yeah.
I mean, who wants memories of that?
That's Danielle Belton, associate editor for The Root. We'll have those videos that we just talked about at hereandnow.org. The hashtag LaughingWhileBlack is exploding on social media. Danielle, thanks for helping us explore this.
Thank you for having me.
And we're coming up on the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, which hammered the Gulf Coast at the end of August 2005. 10 years ago, right now, the storm had just gained hurricane strength as it swept across Florida. It would be downgraded to a tropical storm before regaining strength in the Gulf of Mexico. We want to listen back to some of the memorable moments from the storm and its aftermath. Starting with New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin on August 28, 2005, the day before Katrina hit Louisiana.
A mandatory evacuation order is hereby called for all of the parish of Orleans, with only the following exceptions: essential personnel of the United States of America, State of Louisiana, and City of New Orleans.
Katrina hit with torrential rain and lashing winds over 100 miles an hour. Cornelius Greenway was riding out the storm in Gulfport, Mississippi.
Right now, anybody that would decide to go out in the streets would be, you know, wishing for their death, because anything that hits you at this wind speed could go right through you. When I go out with a Kevlar vest and a helmet. People should stay in their house and try to do their best to stay safe and stay away from the windows.
In greater New Orleans, Katrina's storm surge breached dozens of levees, submerging 80% of the city under several feet of water. Thousands of people were not able to evacuate the city or chose not to. And many of them made their way to the Superdome, where they endured horrible conditions. This is reporter Chris Lawrence on CNN on September 1st, 2005, describing the scene in the stadium.
Thousands and thousands of families have been going for days now without food, without water. They have no communication with the outside world. And to make matters worse, they're scared. One police officer said at some point this afternoon, someone drove by and actually shot at some of these people who are just waiting there to be rescued. They're sitting there, families, mothers with their children, literally with no food or water, waiting to be rescued, and a police officer says someone shot at them. While we were on the ground there, we saw horrible conditions. We saw an elderly woman who had died in a wheelchair. There was no one to come get her. There's no ambulance. There's no pickup. She was just sitting on the side of the road next to the convention center with a blanket over her, right next to her.
President George W. Bush and his administration came under withering criticism for their response to the devastation and human suffering caused by Katrina. And one of the main targets of public anger was Michael Brown, then director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. Brown spoke to CNN's Paula Zahn on September 1st, 2005.
Paula, I think it's so important for the American public to understand exactly how catastrophic this disaster is. I mean, we have a major American city, a major urban area that has been totally demolished. And what we're finding is that people who were unable or chose not to evacuate are suddenly appearing. And so this catastrophic disaster continues to grow.
And what about a situation like you just heard at Charity Hospital tonight, where they were in the process of evacuating patients, and they were told once they got those critically ill patients in a boat, put them on the boat, that the boat had to be sent back because where it was being dispatched to was underwater as well, and there wasn't any reasonable place to leave them off.
And that is a great example, unfortunately a great example, of how catastrophic this disaster is, that we may have a place that we're going to take critically ill patients and suddenly it's not there and we have to change plans on the fly. That's how devastating.
The scale and scope of the disaster continued to grow, and much of what we knew about the destruction was coming from news reports, not the officials in charge. On ABC, people talked about the horrible conditions at the New Orleans Convention Center.
We counted at least three dead bodies at the convention center, inside a hallway, outside on the loading dock.
In a minute, we're going to be eating each other.
Many of these evacuees believe they're being ignored because they're black. They feel officials may be more sympathetic if they knew some victims are white.
This is not an Afro-American. Look at this. Look at this. It's a Caucasian.
We are Americans. This is terrible.
They are not all Americans. Lourdes Munoz is a member of parliament in Spain who was trapped while on vacation here with her husband and son.
It's like genocide, a modern type of genocide, to put 10,000 people in a place like worse than dogs.
On All Things Considered on NPR, Secretary of Homeland Security Michael Chertoff told Robert Siegel it was dangerous to believe what he called rumors coming out of New Orleans.
But second, when you say that we shouldn't listen to rumors, these are things coming from reporters who have not only covered many, many other hurricanes, they've covered wars and refugee camps. Well, I mean, these aren't rumors. They're seeing thousands of people there.
I have not heard a report of thousands of people in the convention center who don't have food and water. I can tell you that I know specifically the Superdome, which was the designated staging area for a large number of evacuees, does have food and water. I know we have teams putting food and water out at other designated evacuation areas.
When Katrina hit the Gulf Coast, President Bush was wrapping up a vacation at his ranch in Crawford, Texas. He first surveyed the damage from Air Force One on his way back to Washington, but he was on the ground in the region on September 2nd. He responded to the criticism that the government's response to the storm was too little, too late.
The faith-based groups and the community-based groups throughout this part of the world, and the country for that matter, are responding. If you want to help, give cash money to the Red Cross and the Salvation Army. That's where the first help will come. There's going to be plenty of opportunities to help later on. But right now, the immediate concern is to save lives and get food and medicine to people so we can stabilize the situation. Again, I want to thank you all and Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job. The FEMA director is working 24/7.
Brownie was, of course, Michael Brown, the FEMA director. 10 days after that pat on the back from the president, Brown resigned. On September 15th, President Bush returned to New Orleans and addressed the nation.
The work of rescue is largely finished. The work of recovery is moving forward. In nearly all of Mississippi, electric power has been restored. Trade is starting to return to the port of New Orleans, and agricultural shipments are moving down the Mississippi River. All major gasoline pipelines are now in operation, preventing the supply disruptions that many feared. The breaks in the levees have been closed, the pumps are running, and the water here in New Orleans is receding by the hour. Environmental officials are on the ground, taking water samples, identifying and dealing with hazardous debris, and working to get drinking water and wastewater treatment systems operating again. And some very sad duties are being carried out by professionals who gather the dead, treat them with respect, and prepare them for their rest. In the task of recovering and rebuilding, some of the hardest work is still ahead, and it will require the creative skill and generosity of a united country.
President Bush speaking on September 15th, 2005, as we listen to some of the sounds from 10 years ago. We want to close with the words of the novelist Richard Ford. He was born in Mississippi, later lived in New Orleans, and he talked about what it was like to watch the suffering in the city he loved.
Just who lives in New Orleans has become very vivid. Mm-hmm. When you look around on those rooftops and who's floating around and walking around with their belongings and Winn-Dixie bags, it's poor people. And a lot of the understory of life in New Orleans, a lot of the things that tourists and residents think of as quaint and romantic, and the things that they come to New Orleans to see because they don't exactly exist anywhere else, is subsistence living. is a population of poor people living in substandard conditions, and that's been brought very vividly to light in the last couple of days. And so, with a kind of from the ruins attitude, which one must now take, you have to hope that New Orleans will see itself beyond its eccentricities and see itself as being a city more like other cities with other cities' problems and begin to address them in the way rather than, in essence, revel in them in the way that other cities do.
Hurricane Katrina did more than $100 billion in damage to the Gulf Coast. It's the single costliest natural disaster in U.S. history. The official death toll from the storm, more than 1,800 people, but the real number of dead may never be known. Dozens of the victims were never identified, their bodies never claimed. The remains are interred in the New Orleans Katrina Memorial at the end of Canal Street.
And August is drawing to a close. I can't believe it, Jeremy. It's so sad.
Yeah.
There is still time to celebrate National Sandwich Month.
is that what this is?
That is August. Or the beginning of the school year, because sandwiches become fine art during the year. So resident chef Kathy Gunst is here to talk about one of our favorite finger foods. Kathy, expound on sandwiches.
Well, they are very popular. Mm-hmm. All over the world. You name a country and there is a sandwich from it, from the Scandinavian open face sandwiches to French tartines to Vietnamese banh mi to American peanut butter and jelly, grilled cheese, tuna fish, egg salad, on and on and on. And it is. It's National Sandwich Month. Woo-hoo. Who knew?
And this all came, as legend would have it, from the Earl of Sandwich.
Well, yes, the fourth Earl of Sandwich, Jeremy,
Earl.
Please.
Yes.
John Montague was supposedly gambling in London in the 1700s for 24 hours straight. Try that one. And he got very hungry and did not want to stop gambling. So he put a slice of roast beef between two slices of bread and he didn't want to interrupt his game. Supposedly that was what began it. But 800 years before the Earl, the fourth Earl, a rabbi of all people, it was Passover, the Jewish holiday, and he made a Hillel sandwich. And that involves taking two pieces of matzah with herbs, and matzah, of course, is the unleavened bread, and the herbs symbolized the pain and the bitterness of slavery, and the breads resembled the flatbreads that were made in haste by the ancient Israelites as they fled Egypt. We could fight it out forever.
Okay, but let's not.
Good for us
that
it exists.
Let's talk about these sandwiches that are
Yeah, let's cut to the chase here. But let me ask you both a question. Growing up, what was your favorite sandwich?
You have it right in front of me. I have to eat this. This is a
tomatoes.
Okay, so Robin's favorite sandwich
that involves
summer tomatoes.
Maybe tuna, but you don't have to. I used to
Did you have your tomato sandwich on Wonder Bread?
No, we were. But although, let me ask you about that. I have this gorgeous tomato sandwich. I want to ask you about it. But let's just talk about bread, because we're talking to Dan Buehler of Blue Zone Solutions. And one of the things he says is, you know, bread is, it can be negative for you unless it's whole wheat or sprouted or a certain kind of sourdough.
Yeah, I mean, I think bread gets a very bad rap. Yeah. I think in moderation, it's great. I think if you eat sandwiches three times a day, you're going to get into trouble. What you have before you, Robin, is a 4-grain whole grain bread with fresh ricotta cheese, salt, pepper, a green zebra tomato that was picked from my garden about 3 hours ago, and a beautiful, I can't remember the variety, a red tomato. So we have a slice of green, a slice of red. People will see it on the website. Drizzle of olive oil, crumbled fresh basil, salt and pepper. To me also, I'm telling you, that is summer on a sandwich. But it's an open face, and that's another way to get around the bread issue. But have one piece.
I would be eating it if it were Wonder Bread, and I'm going to. Jeremy, take over.
Well, by the way, I'll answer your question. I was a grilled ham and cheese person as a kid.
Interesting.
Yeah. But this looks much more interesting. So what do you have here?
Well, so for you, Jeremy, I have two sandwiches. The first one on the plate there is a Hero Sandwich, developed by my friend Shannon Hill. She and her husband own Maine Meat, her partner actually, which is a sustainable butcher shop in Kittery, Maine. You've got pickled onions. I don't know if she pickles them, but I did. Provolone cheese, lettuce from my garden, tomato from my garden, zucchini relish. You've got Coto ham, which Jared smokes. It's amazing. You've got a picante. You've got two types of salami.
It's a lot harder to talk back to you, Kathy, when the segment is about sandwiches.
Like
they
you.
Really do
yeah,
fill
right?
up your
I'm
mouth.
I'm not saying anything anymore.
Right, right.
Except just keep talking.
That's an amazing sandwich.
Yeah. I mean, the idea of these things is that you're just layering flavor. That's what you want to aim for in a sandwich. You don't want just one thing or two. You want to layer lots of flavors on. Think of any sandwich that you eat all the time, including a grilled cheese. And what would happen if you shredded daikon radish on it, or grated carrots, or what if you took that tomato sandwich and just threw a whole bunch of herbs on there, or some smoked turkey. You want to just keep thinking outside the box.
And again, these are at hereandnow.org. We've got the recipes. But what is this one, Kathy?
So this is my favorite.
Yeah, that's a Reuben, and that's from Zingerman's Deli
in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Can we just say hi to Zingerman's? We just love them.
It's pretty fabulous. So they send this kit in the mail, and you get your corned beef, and you heat that up in the oven, and you get this gorgeous rye bread, and you heat it up, and beautiful Swiss cheese, and Russian dressing, and sauerkraut. Everything's heated. You put it in a skillet till the cheese is melting. What do you think? Mm. All the way from Michigan. Mm-mm-mm.
You know, we had some very serious
he
questions.
He can't talk. I really,
no.
really like this.
About
He's usually giving me a hard time. And
Just one. And we'll have all this information here now.org. But this is an excuse for us to eat sandwiches. But what's the best way to keep a sandwich from getting soggy?
Sometimes the best way is to keep the elements separate if you're packing it for the office or a kid's box lunch for school. Uh-huh. In other words, don't put the tomato on it yet. Don't put the lettuce on them. Let them put it on at the last minute. A little bit of olive oil on the bread, too, keeps it from, you know, getting the soggy sandwich, bad news.
Here and now, resident chef Kathy Gunst
with some sandwiches.
And we've got them again at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thanks as always.
Thanks, guys.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. We're saying goodbye to our intern, Christina Bartson, who's going back to Emerson College.
We'll give her part of our sandwich.
It's all yours, Christina. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.